Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. My topic tonight is growing organic, the dirt on growing organic fruits and vegetables. The idea of going organic when it comes to buying organic fruits and vegetables has continued to grow in popularity as people realize its true value. But what does it mean for those trying to grow organic? Tonight we look behind the grocery store and the farmers markets to explore the secrets behind growing organic food from farmers' fields to local gardens. As the interest in organic produce continues to rise, can farmers keep up? How is San Francisco's April legislation help? And what can individuals do in their own backyard, be it the city or the suburb? Joining me to answer these questions and more are in studio Jason Mark. He's a farmer, writer, and veteran environmental activist. His writings on agriculture and the environment have appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, The Nation, The Progressive, and The Orion, as well as others. And he's the editor of the quarterly magazine Earth Island Journal. When he's not writing, he co-manages Alamany Farm, a 3-acre organic fruit and vegetable garden in San Francisco. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks so much.
And over the phone, we have Maureen Wilmot. She's the newly appointed executive director of the Organic Farming Research Foundation, which promotes organic farming in research grants, policy, and the continued advancement of the organic agenda. Maureen is a trained biologist with some professional background in policy development, nonprofit management, and community activism. And her professional and personal life is focused on sustainability with an emphasis on organic foods, ocean conservation, and green building. Welcome, Maureen.
Thanks for inviting me.
And my last guest is Daryl Wong. He is one of three owners and managers of Freewheelin' Farm. He and his two partners manage 7 acres of North Santa Cruz on the ocean side of Highway 1. And together they grow a diverse range of 30 to 40 crops, all sold through their community-supported agriculture program and to restaurants in Santa Cruz, the peninsula, and San Francisco. And Daryl is a graduate of the Apprenticeship in Ecological Horticulture at UC Santa Cruz and has worked in agriculture since 2004. Welcome, Daryl. Thanks for being a part of our show.
Thanks so much, Lauren. Glad to be here.
And, of course, we'll be taking calls from you. We would like to hear your thoughts and opinions, so give us a call at 415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Really excited to have you all here. It's such an important topic, and we rarely look behind the fruits and vegetables that we actually see being sold. So I want to start with you, Jason. You're the co-manager of Alamany Farm, which is a 3-acre organic fruit and vegetable garden in San Francisco, as well as a writer. Can you tell us kind of what's happening with the whole organic sector, if you will, these days?
I think organic is, you titled tonight's program Going Organic. It seems to me that organic is kind of facing a lot of growing pains. You know, 40 years ago, a lot of back to the landers and kind of hippie folks decided, well, let's grow food a different way without using chemical pesticides and herbicides and chemical fossil fuel based fertilizers. And since then, that's become a multi-billion dollar industry, which is now 3 to 4% of the U.S. food industry and growing far faster than the industrial food system is every year. It's growing about 20% a year. And so when I talk about growing pains, it's really how do you take some of that sort of still, I think, and would love to hear what Daryl and Maureen think, is still sort of in its adolescence. And how do we go from 3 or 4% of the U.S. food system, which is great, but is really insufficient? How do we get to 30 or 40% of the U.S. food system? And that's going to involve a lot of hard work. As a gardener would say, that's a long row to hoe. And certainly, there's a lot of things that consumers can do. There's a lot of things that growers can do, but fundamentally, I think one of the most important things is going to be, as we're heading into 2012, going to have a reauthorization of the U.S. Farm Bill, or what some people like to call the Food Bill, and that's going to be a really important opportunity to ensure that organics can have a level playing field with the industrial food economy that has given so much incentives and extra help by public policy, and to make sure that we've got a level playing field so we can keep growing this and sort of go from adolescence to more of a mature more of a mature food sector.
Was there a time, while looking back at history, when really everything was organic as we define it today?
Yeah, I mean, 100 years ago.
But,
yeah,
I mean, when,
sure,
I should say, when did it actually change?
So that, well, there's a guy named Woody Tash who's got a great group called Slow Money, the idea of sort of being sort of like slow food but for investors. And he points out that, you know, Attila the Hun, Susan B. Anthony, Julius Caesar, and Abraham Lincoln all had one thing in common. They all ate organic foods, right? That's the only kind of foods that there were.
Right.
And so I think it's actually important to point out, I don't say the conventional food system. I deliberately say the industrial food system, because we've had one kind of way of growing food for the, you know, the 20th century fashion. That's actually a huge break from the last 10,000 years of how we've grown food as agriculturalists and pastoralists. And it seems strange to me that we call the way that we've done things for 60 years conventional, but doing the way things have been done for 10,000 years has to have this special name, organic. So I think that should really be flipped around.
And do you, as a small farm, a small farmer...
A market garden.
A market garden. Is that what you call yourself?
Sure.
A market garden. Okay.
We only say farm because by San Francisco standards, it feels pretty big. Daryl's got a real farm. Cleveland Farm is one of my favorite farms around. It's awesome.
Did you, why did you get started in having your own garden, if you will?
So I was working as a journalist and as a campaigner at the San Francisco-based human rights group Global Exchange from 1999 to 2005. And during that time became increasingly concerned about issues like climate change and like peak oil and oil depletion. And began to worry about how are we going to continue to grow our own food in the 21st century as climate change starts to have some real dislocations on the weather systems that we've, you know, that we rely on, and how are we going to grow food without all the oil we depend on. And so, like Daryl actually was an instructor of mine at the UC Santa Cruz Farm and Garden, enrolled in that program in 2005 because I wanted to learn how to grow my own food, and then was fortunate enough to bring those skills back to the city and to help revitalize Alamany Farm, which today is the largest food production site in San Francisco.
And your farm's special. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, kind of how you set it up?
Well,
and
it's
who
special.
Works there
just and... It's special insofar as, you know, not many people are growing organic fruits and vegetables next to, you know, 10 lanes of freeway and 165 unit public housing complex. So just being in an urban location makes things a lot different. But just like, and so though at a smaller scale, similar to Freewheeling Farm that Daryl co-manages, you know, we're using best organic practices. So, and the idea there is really taking traditional knowledge and grafting onto that, you know, modern contemporary 21st century science to sustain the soil and to grow the largest amount of fruits and vegetables we can in a small amount of space.
Okay. Well, thank you. And why don't we move over to Daryl? Daryl, you know, your scale is a lot larger. What sort of challenges have you faced as you try to monetize and make sure that you guys have a place in the market?
Yeah, well, I just want to, I mean, we are much larger, I suppose, than Alamany Farm, maybe double the size, but still by, you know, as Jason said, industrial agricultural standards, were a minuscule farm. I think the USDA classifies small farms in somewhere under the 150-acre range. So we're basically a blip. But to come back to your your question about, I think, the overall challenges that we have, and really I think Jason put it well in terms of how do we kind of grow the organic movement from, you know, kind of an adolescence into a real maturity. The challenges that we've had is really, I think, is really in kind of securing more of that market share. I think, like Jason said, you know, organic food is about 3 to 4% of the overall food system. And as I once heard the CEO of Stonyfield Farm say, you know, that's a margin of error in the overall food system. So basically, by a rounding error, organic food is no longer there. So our biggest challenge is really kind of breaking into that, into the larger picture. So I think, you know, when farms got going and kind of the organic back to the land movement back in kind of the 80s and into the 90s, there was a whole host of consumers that were really interested in that type of produce. And in many ways, we've really tapped that market pretty well. So the farmers market, the CSA customers, those people that are kind of already already in the choir, you know, it's not worth us anymore kind of preaching to them. What we really need to do, I think, as organic producers and, you know, as organic farming advocates, is really figure out how we can move that knowledge and that passion and that education around what organic food is and why it's so important, and really bring it to that larger audience. Because I think, in general, it's just there's so many people in between point A and point B that could be experiencing, you know, more than organic food. It's just really clean, healthy, vital food that's just full of vitamins and nutrients, and it's really good for you, and it's really tasty. So I think for us, the challenge is really starting to break out of the more, what I would say, conventional organic pathways of farmers market, CSA, and kind of fancy restaurants, to really see, you know, how can we begin to bring the food that we're growing to the larger population.
Now, I know for a lot of the people that I know, I mean, organic, they have the means to actually buy organic, and they know how important it is, and they're willing to spend some money. But the truth is that it is more expensive than the conventional foods. Is there anything from your end that could happen that could bring the price point down, or is it really just because of the way you have to farm, or because you don't have as much market share, it is what it is?
Well, I think in some senses there is a little bit of an economy of scale that goes on. So, you know, as we're a growing farm, I think when we farmed on less acreage, you know, we didn't quite have the scale that we do now, where I feel like we can produce food and sell it at a lower cost and still be able to make a profit from that. But overall, I think what Jason pointed to in the Farm Bill is really leveling the playing field with what is the kind of industrial food system. And that's a big deal, because I think so much of the large-scale food that we see and what we set as our baseline for food prices is actually highly subsidized by the government.
Right.
And that happens through the Farm Bill. So I think rather than say, how can we bring our price point down, I think the discussion should more be about how can we level the playing field for, you know, new, younger, first-generation producers that are really getting into this market that don't get to claim some of those same subsidies that some of our more the main crop growers in our country do.
Okay, you know, and before we go any further, Daryl, I want to just, maybe you could define for people, what is the essence of a vegetable being organic as opposed to local? You know, in the sense of, like, I think that sometimes those words, if you go to grocery stores, are sort of used as, like, something that's really good. But organic, obviously, is you know, is more special. And so just for people, listeners, I think most listeners probably know, but just in case, what makes a vegetable, you know, defines a vegetable? Well, you know, how could someone define their produce as organic? What would it take?
Well, I think, you know, technically, it's a label, and it's a federally regulated label, and that, you know, if you grow organically, you have to follow any number of specific requirements around what you apply to your fields, how you plant your fields, crop rotations, and things like that. And there's a whole other debate about, you know, is that label actually being watered down because of the growth in the industry and the amount of big business that's now getting into organic? And are they actually co-opting the label in a way that it's diminishing those standards, so that you can't actually trust that the food that was grown in both an environmentally friendly way and, I think, holds some of the health benefits that it was intended to? But in general, I like to say, you know, it's like when I go to the supermarket, if it's in the winter and we don't have produce coming out of our fields, I'll buy organic, because I know that at least that produce wasn't sprayed with pesticides. And for the most part, it wasn't. It's not using some of the most kind of damaging, you know, fertilizers that end up into our watershed. So I think, as a real basic explanation, you know, there's less chemicals involved in the growing of the food for an organic product. And that's kind of what I latch onto on a real basic level about what organic means to me.
Does it go even further to the seed that, you know, the actual seed that's planted too?
Yes and no. I mean, technically you are supposed to buy organic seed if you're an organic producer, and organic starts if you're buying, say, crowns for strawberries. But the reality is that there's a I forget what they call it. It's a price opt-out clause, where if the price of organic seed or organic starts is cost prohibitive for your operation, you actually don't have to buy organic seeds or organic starts. And what we've actually found in strawberry production in California is that because I think there are certain members of industry that sit on, you know, certain boards, that for strawberry production, you actually don't have to buy organic starts to certify your strawberry crop as organic. And what that's done is the sole producer of organic strawberry crowns, which produced great crowns, couldn't compete in that in that kind of more industrial market. So they actually went out of business this past year because the standards were so watered down. So I think ideally you are supposed to buy organic seed, and I think many producers, small producers, do. But I think overall the reality is it's not necessary.
So are there certain vegetables or fruits where it's more important? For example, you know, there's a huge problem with corn, right? In the, I don't know, maybe I'll just ask that. Are there certain fruits or vegetables where it's more important to have organic seed?
I mean, I think in all, you know, in all senses, because the seed has to be grown from a plant, and that plant either has to be grown organically or conventionally / industrially. So I think in certain cases, I think it's always better to buy organic seed. And I think what you might be getting at is the genetically modified aspect mm-hmm. of some of these seeds.
Right.
And organic, you know, if anything's labeled organic, it can't be a GMO seed.
Mm-hmm.
So if if you're selling corn in organic cornflakes, it can't be GMO corn.
Okay. Well, thank you, Darren. Let me bring in Maureen Wilmot. Maureen, you are the newly appointed executive director of the Organic Farming Research Foundation. You're looking at policy issues and research grants, and you've done a lot of interesting research. What research is have you done most recently? Has your organization done most recently that you've found, I guess, most interesting?
Well, our research grants are...
Oh, and Maureen, are you on? If you're on a speakerphone, if you wouldn't mind not being on a speakerphone, if that's possible.
Sure. Hold on. Can you hear me?
Yes, that's
okay.
A lot better.
Great. So, you know, we have funded research grants for the last 20 years, and we've given out over $2.7 million in research. And these are farmer-driven. They're ideas that come from organic farmers, and that was really the genesis of our organization is, you said, you know, kind of what was the lack of research out there for people who want to farm organically. Daryl and Jason talked about going back to the land. Actually, we really are using, we want to use the latest technologies out there to farm productively to meet this rising demand for organic. So our research is about production. And we have a whole slew of our research results that are posted on our web. And I think that would take up the whole hour if I started listing all of them. But I think I really thought your question about what are some of the challenges facing organic farmers and as we're growing this. And it is a growing business, and I think it is okay to say it's a business, because I am fortunate to work in a national organization and to meet some of the innovators. This is American ingenuity at the best, because these are men and women who are farming in a way that isn't prescribed. It's not, spray your fields at this date and then harvest at this date. It's figuring out how are they going to grow those corn or that pumpkin or that special squash that they've saved the seeds for six generations, and how are they going to grow it without pesticides and herbicides and without chemical fertilizers. So as I said, I just am so fortunate. I get to meet men and women across the country. So there are certified organic farmers in every state in this country. And I know that you guys are talking about your farms and their 3 and 6 acres. I have a board member with a 400-acre organic farm in North Dakota. I have one of my board members raises organic apples in Wisconsin. And we had one of our board members supplied all the milk, the organic milk and yogurt for Fairfield, Iowa. He has a 80-head of Jersey cows in the middle of Iowa, and there we are, where his town only eats his organic yogurt. So I think we need to look at this growing industry as this is the face of American farmers. This one, with our policy work, we fly farmers to D.C. so they can meet with their legislators to talk about the farm bill and to make sure that there's more funding in the farm bill for research. The millions and billions of dollars in our farm bill that goes to fund conventional agriculture, we want at least, and if not more, funding that funds organic research coming out of the USDA. So we fly our farmers into D.C. This one kid, he is a second-generation farmer from upstate New York, and he farms because he's a Christian, and he believes that it's his right, his gift to God to take care of the land that God has given to steward. And the only way to do that is to farm organically. A fifth-generation rancher from southwest Georgia, grass-fed beef, and he supplies all the meat for Whole Foods, all grass-fed, all organic, and from Georgia all the way up to Cleveland, Ohio. So we're talking about this growing face of the American farmer and to meet the growing demand out there. And what we need to do in our policies is to build the infrastructure for these farmers, whether they're 3 acres and they're, you know, back to landers, or they're just starting out, or they're, you know, a 1,000-acre wheat farmer in Montana. We need to make sure that we have the infrastructure there. We need to make sure that our folks in D.C. who are putting together the farm bill and that we're voting for are knowing that organic farming in this country has the voice of the constituents behind it. We always say we want people to vote with their forks and vote with their vote. So that's some of the policy challenges that we're seeing, is that we may need to make sure that the infrastructure is there so that we can support these folks who want to farm organically, who make that choice to provide better food for people in this country and to that it's better for the environment.
If you're just joining us, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing organic farming and gardens. My guests are Jason Mark, co-manager of San Francisco's Alamany Farm and editor of the Earth Island Journal. Maureen Wilmot, who's the newly appointed executive director of the Organic Farming Research Foundation, and Daryl Wong, farmer and co-owner of Freewheelin' Farm. If you'd like to join us, here's the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or join us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I'm curious, all these three farmers have talked about voting with your fork, the need for consumers. Do you shop organic? And if not, what is keeping you from buying and growing the business? Again, the number is 415-841-4134, or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I want to go to our first caller for the evening. We have Susan from San Francisco. Good evening, Susan.
Hi, good evening. What a great program. I think my question is probably directed toward either Jason or Daryl. Maureen, if you have any input, I'd really appreciate it. I'm practicing integrated pest management. I'm planting beneficial plants with my primary crops. And my question is, I'm using large, you know, big like fabric pots. So I have my primary crop, you know, say Brussels sprouts in the middle, and then I'm putting something like a marigold or a nicotiana kind of around the edge of that pot. And my question is that, are those beneficial plants, which are certainly doing their job in terms of helping me not have so much predation from insects, but are they leaching out vitamins and minerals from my primary crop? And in a larger sense, when I'm doing beneficial plantings, how near or far to my primary crops
You've got, it sounds like you've got a really specific question, but the interesting thing, and I'm going to let Jason take this, and maybe he can give you like a little bit of help, and maybe you can contact him offline if it's not good enough. But, you know, I think that, you know, that it sounds like, you know, what you're talking about is that a little bit of, that part of this whole organic farming is not just, you know, the pesticides, but also kind of the way plants are put together, and the order, and so maybe Jason, you can help and talk a little bit about that.
So when Susan says IPM, for listeners out there, that means integrated pest management, and one of the core principles of organic farming or ecological farming is encouraging biodiversity, right? Because nature abhors a monocrop. You don't find a monocrop anywhere in nature. Of course, if you're driving through, you know, large industrial ag lands, let's say, of course, like in the corn and soy belt of the Midwest, but even the San Joaquin Valley, you can drive, you know, for dozens of miles through one crop, broccoli. And that encourages a lot of pests and diseases when you just have a monocrop, one thing. And so one of the things that organic agriculture does is to, again, have a polyculture, is to encourage biodiversity. And the idea is biomimicry. As organic agriculture works, the idea of let's look at how nature works and try, as the Organic Farming Research Foundation has done in so many of their great grants, is to look at some of the best available science and how can we mimic some of the things that nature does. And what Susan's doing is she's planting marigolds to track beneficial insects and probably the Nicotiana to actually kill you know, pests that are going to be in her garden. The short answer, Susan, is you're going to want to treat those like a crop, and you're going to have to feed them just as much, and you're going to want to make sure you've got adequate soil fertility to not only take care of your productive vegetable crops, like your Brussels sprouts or whatever it might be, but also your the crops you've planted there to attract beneficial insects or to, like the Nicotiana, poison pests that you don't want in your garden and poison them in a natural fashion. I guess I'd just real quickly say, if you know, if people who want more information, there's actually a really great event coming up this Saturday, hosted by EcoSF at School of the Arts. I think it's called Roots to Fruits, and Pam Pierce, the master gardener of the Bay Area who wrote Golden Gate Gardening, will be there giving workshops. All sorts of classes are held at City College, at Garden for the Environment, at 7th and Lawton, at Alamany Farm. So there's so many resources that are out there.
Let me just reintroduce City Visions. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Lauren Meltzer. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the dirt behind local organic farms and gardens. And joining me are Jason Mark, co-manager of San Francisco's Alamany Farm and editor of Earth Justice Journal, Maureen Wilmot, Executive Director of Organic of the Organic Farming Research Foundation, and Daryl Wong, farmer and co-owner of Free Willin' Farm. If you'd like to join us, you can by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. We have another caller, Bob from San Francisco. Good evening, Bob.
Yeah, it's Bob from Palo Alto.
Oh, Bob from Palo Alto. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have a double-sided question, or two questions. Your speakers, your panelists have indicated that there is government regulation specifically for organic farming. And, of course, we all know that there is also government regulation for non-organic products that reach the marketplace as well. And what I want to know is as a consumer, how much harm am I doing myself to buy just regular, normal food produced in non-organic ways as opposed to organic? And second, if there is harm, and a substantial harm, either cancer or skin disease or some sort of dementia, which occurs as people get older, caused by what you're eating in the normal marketplace, why isn't the government protecting us from that? So I wonder if the speakers could hit those two points.
Maureen or Daryl?
I'm happy to talk about
okay,
that.
Okay, great. Maureen Wilmot.
So when you're talking about the label, the sort of the organic label, it says that you farm in a way that, you know, you don't use chemical fertilizers, you don't use chemical pesticides, and so you're not going to, if you have an organic strawberry, you won't have that on the fruit that you're going to eat or the apple. And actually, organic, whether you whether you think the label is watered down or not, it still is the most regulated food system that we have, and that the paperwork that an organic farmer has to do to track their process and the inspections. Now, if you're the recent studies that have come out that actually have said, well, with the president's study, and it just short of saying eat organic to prevent cancer. So there are studies that are coming out about the health benefits of eating organic food. And if you just think about it, it's got less pesticides. If that's the one thing. So I'm not as thoroughly briefed in the conventional farming or chemical farming and the inspections and what is allowed, but it probably does fit within, standards of the government. But I do know that I would prefer the organic standards because it's much stricter and it's much more, again, no pesticides. And for me, the next level is what that farming method does for the environment. That I know that there's less runoff because of organic farming practices. Actually, there's this study that just said that there's 50% less nitrogen runoff from organic farms. Well, if we would convert every acre in the Mississippi Basin to organic farming, we would do away with the dead zone. So I know when I'm eating, it's not just for my own health.
Do away with what?
The dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So now I know when I'm eating organic food, it's not just a benefit to my health and my children's health. It's a benefit to the environment.
Maureen, is it?
Just to repeat the key to my question, if in fact pesticides do harm to an individual, how is it possible that the government allows that product to be eaten by the majority of the population?
Jason, why don't you help on this one, too?
One of the things that, and Maureen was sort of alluding to this, is if you're an organic farmer, you have to do far more paperwork than any industrial farmer in this country. The industrial farmers actually really just need a pesticide applicator's license. Once you have your pesticide applicator's license, there's little to no oversight on the actual production methods of your crops. Now, of course, once they start to head towards market, then there are USDA rules or FDA rules depending upon what you're selling. I think your question is, is the government, it seems unlikely the government would put us at risk. But the issue is that many of the EPA or USDA, and they're mostly EPA regulations that govern pesticides, and Maureen, correct me if I'm wrong, are usually just testing a single pesticide in isolation and determining what is an acceptable burden of parts per million of that chemical for a given organism. The danger comes, of course, because we're using many different pesticides that are mixing all together in ways that have never been studied. And then you start to really increase the body burden for you and your family. I think Maureen's totally right. It's not just about your personal health. It's about the health of the environment. But I think you can go and I believe the best source out there is the Organic Consumers Association. I think it's organicconsumers.org. And they've got a list of the dirty dozen. Here are the most heavily sprayed fruits and vegetables that you really want to avoid. And again, the risk starts to become, what if this is accumulating over the years that you've been eating, over the decades that you've been eating? What is then the body burden to you and your family who you're providing food for?
And Lauren, if I could chime in on
that. Yes, Daryl.
I really think that, the thing that comes up for me is that, why would the USDA allow or the EPA allow some of these things to be passed? And I think many of them actually are highly regulated, so that there have been studies that are done that will probably show all types of cancers or heart disease or showing up in rats for high accumulations of these pesticides. But they've, for some reason, decided that, like Jason said, at a certain dosage, at parts per million, for a certain crop, that's okay. And I don't think there's been... I think it's probably hard to really study the long-term effects of those on a human population for the accumulation effects. But then the second part is that agriculture is big business. And even though we know that, say, methyl iodide, which is used to basically sterilize the soil for strawberry production and is a major, I think, autoimmune disruptor, or endocrine disruptor, I'm not sure which, but even though that has been shown time and time again that as it gets into the watershed and it actually affects human health, not just the environment health, but human health down the road, that's still allowed because it's considered so vital to the production of conventional or industrial strawberries, so that they can't rule out that single pesticide because it's so integral to how most of the strawberries are grown, actually just south of us here in the Central Coast.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Thank you so much for that question. That was a really good question. Let me go back. Let me continue with you, Daryl. I'm curious, when it comes to, you know, obviously pesticides were introduced to be able to allow farmers to have more control over having more, how much they produce each season. So what sort of strategies do you use? Is it what Jason alluded to in terms of kind of these natural crop rotation and having certain crops as part of the mix that, serve as protectors against the people that, you know, the animals and insects that would eat? Or do you have other strategies?
Yeah, well, what I always tell people, because so many people ask that question, and the basic tenets, what I feel like, of organic agriculture is that good, healthy soil creates good, healthy plants, which, like a good, healthy person, has its own immune system, its own defenses to kind of pest and disease. And I think that something that's really telling about kind of organic farmers and organic farming is that land that's been farmed organically for many years, for decades at a time, just gets better and better. So you know that what you're doing is actually making what you do even easier, which seems to me like you're probably doing something right. So in terms of kind of pests, pesticides and fungicides, what we end up doing is we really try to focus on the health of the soil. So that is managing our micronutrients. It's using cover crops and allowing natural decomposition to happen in our fields that then provides a whole host of kind of micronutrients and other benefits that I don't think, you can really even quantify in individual parts. But beyond that, the idea of a crop rotation so that, each crop that's in the soil comes from, after you take one crop out and you put another crop in, it's of a different plant family. So it's probably going to take different nutrients and not tax the soil in the same way. So once again, you have a healthier plant overall. And then when none of that works, we end up losing, maybe we lose 5 or 8% of our crop to some pest or disease. And we kind of figure that's an environment tax. It's something that we're willing to give up in our production system so that we don't have to spray these gnarly chemicals that we would have to be suited up for and have a special license for and make sure none of our workers were in the field for. So we kind of feel like that type of tax is worth it if we lose a small percentage of our crop.
What, one of the things that is noticeable is when you go to a grocery store and you see all this beautiful looking produce, and then you go to the organic section, and it doesn't necessarily look as beautiful, because, and I'm saying that, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, beautiful, because, maybe they don't, all the strawberries aren't perfectly red, or the apples might not be perfectly shaped, or so how much value do organic farmers place on the look? And is that something that you lose when you try to farm organically? I don't know, Jason, do you want to answer this?
Oh, can I? I'm going to chime in because I think, Lauren,
sure.
think you need to come to my farmer's market because
okay.
I think I've seen the organic produce is some of the most beautiful produce I've
okay.
ever seen. So you need to shop at my market.
Yeah, I think I'd push back a little bit too. I think when I go to the farmer's market, it's uniformly some of the most beautiful produce I see. I think if you go to Whole Foods, where probably 2/3 of the produce is organic, it's almost like, gallery museum showcase quality. I think a little bit of that is kind of a hangover of maybe some stereotypes that were there earlier. And I think, as Daryl said, healthy soil equals healthy plants. I think in general you see the organic produce because it's more vibrant, because it's more recently picked and in general fresher, especially if you're buying from the farmer's market, it has more life to it and it sort of is more attractive, I think.
Well, then maybe I should address it just the flaw. I mean, I agree. When I go to farmers markets, I feel the same way. But I would say that when the conventional, there's really a big push to have things look perfect, you know, to look perfect in order to be sold. Is it true then, do organic farmers place the same value, or in terms of when you're thinking about what you're going to bring to market, do you think the same way, Daryl?
Yeah, Lauren, I've got kind of two thoughts on that. One is, more than I think the produce looking more, I forget the word you use, maybe perfect, I think it looks much more standard. And that really is an industry, that's defined by industry. So there are packing standards for most of the crops, especially all the specialty crops, which is basically any vegetable that you grow. If you're going to sell to the wholesale market, there are packing standards. So all of that produce has to be the same size. You have to fit the same count in a certain box so that you can sell it kind of anonymously to any distributor, and they can then sell that to any grocery store, and any grocery store can buy a case of romaine lettuce and know that there's 24 heads in a case. But what I would say is, I would kind of echo what Maureen said about, you know, come look at my farmer's market, and what Jason said about the freshness of the pick, and take another challenge to say, sign up for our CSA, you know, sign up for our supported agriculture program, because literally, I think we actually get a lot of feedback from our members that the quality of our food is so much higher than anything they've seen before. And a lot of that, I mean, I will take credit for growing good food, but also it's about the freshness, like Jason said, because we pick our food either that day or the day before, and before it gets to the consumer. And in most any grocery store that you go to, that produce was picked. It was picked in the field. You know, there's probably a day in cooling, a day or two in transportation. Once it gets to the store, it stays a day before it gets onto the shelf. So already you're looking at produce that is, you know, 5 to 7 days old. And that produce is just not going to have the same freshness and the same flavor that fresh-picked, you know, fresh-picked strawberries are a perfect example, because we pick our strawberries the day that they're delivered. So when our customers get them and they eat them right there at the stand, they say, oh, my God, these are the best strawberries I've ever had, because we actually pick the strawberries when they're ripe. Versus most of the strawberries that you see in Whole Foods, that you see in kind of any market, have to be picked slightly underripe so that they don't rot during transport. And what I've heard, a favorite saying of mine is that real peaches don't stack, you know, because they bruise. And my kind of corollary of that is that real berries don't last. So you should be eating berries that were picked fresh. And yes, sometimes that means there's going to be a little bit more of a blemish, a little bit more of an overripeness on them. But I think the flavor is going to make up for it above and beyond.
Well, but Daryl, then let me kind of beg the question, what, you know, one of the selling points is the freshness. So if you're going to try to grow and scale, are you going to be able to continue to provide that, or how, what will get lost?
Yeah. So I think that there are plenty of examples out there of kind of CSA programs that are much larger than ours, that still are able to provide that type of high quality kind of eating or food experience. And I think that's where, when I start to think about what are the new marketing avenues, some of the new technologies, you know, whether it's all the new kind of like high-tech iPhone apps or ways to basically connect the consumer to a farm so that we can really shrink that that distance between the farmer and the consumer, and also allow the farmer to collect kind of more of that retail dollar. And I think that those are things we're going to have to address as the whole organic industry continues to grow and mature.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the dirt behind growing organic. Joining me are Jason Marr, co-manager of San Francisco's Alemany Farm and editor of Earth Island Journal, Maureen Wilmot, the executive director of the Organic Farming Research Foundation, and Daryl Wong, farmer and co-owner of Free Will and Farm. If you'd like to join us, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or join us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And again, the number is 415-841-4134, or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. We have both some calls and email to go to, but let me go back to Jason. Did you want to add something?
I was just going to say, I mean, I think part of this is about knitting together or recreating the system of truck farms we used to have in this country. I mean, you know, a couple generations ago, let's say at the end of World War II, much of New York City would get its fresh produce within a day's drive of the city, right? Truck farms that were in northern New Jersey in the Hudson River Valley. In Chicago, you had a circle of truck farms around the city. Here in the Bay Area, farms, of course, in Sonoma or Santa Cruz counties that were supporting the city. And Daryl's doing that today, right, with a farm south of Pescadero that is bringing up produce, and they drop it off every week at Garden for the Environment and 7th and Lawton. So it's about recreating and deliberately, intentionally reestablishing some of the food systems that we tossed out, unfortunately, after World War II.
And I think there's some easy, some easy ways to look at it in terms of how, you know, we can both scale up and keep the produce fresh. We just started selling to a great market in San Francisco, Buyright.
Buyright, really?
And we deliver our produce on Tuesday, and they sell it for the next couple of days. To sell to Whole Foods, you have to be of such a scale, you know, probably on 100, you know, you have to sell to such a scale to actually be able to, what they say, backdoor to the grocery store, which means actually deliver directly to them. Most people that sell to Whole Foods have to sell to their central distribution center. So even if they grew produce right next to a Whole Foods, they would probably have to send it up to the main distribution point and then have it come back to the store.
Well, it's crazy. Well, let me go to some of our callers. We have Suchit from Santa Clara. Good evening.
Yeah, hi. Am I on the air?
Yes. Welcome to City Visions.
It's a great show, and I heard about comparing the organic farming versus non-organic, and I was wondering if there are statistics on the per acre yield on organic farming versus non-organic to find out what is the cost or higher cost of organic goods coming from, number one. And number two, are there scientific methods already invented which can be used to convince the non-organic farmers to use organic farming and still provide this, to get the same amount of yield that is required to have a successful business at scale?
No, those are great questions. Jason, do you want to take that?
So you want to compare the organic versus conventional, the higher cost for organic. Why is it higher?
Or the yield.
Well,
yeah, and the yield.
And the yield.
What is the yield comparison?
So let's go to the cost of farming. So some, and you guys who have the farms, I'll let you chime in. But from what we look at with our across the nation and looking at organic farming on the national level, we figure it's about three times as more. The cost of farming organically is about three times as much as farming conventionally, and many of that. Much of that cost can be attributed to labor cost. So instead of that being a negative, we look at that. That's a positive because that means job creation. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that organic should be supported, is that it means more jobs in your rural communities. Then at the farm gate, the what the organic farmer gets for that, it is they are paid a premium. They do make more than, again, nationally, organic farmers and organic farms have a higher rate of return than conventional farms. And now, as far as production, that's always a question of organic farms can't yield. Well, that's really a myth. Here, our studies are showing they're about 80 to 90% as much as conventional farming. They're up there. In developing countries, in fact, organic farming practices outcompete conventional farming practices. So I do say that we can, in organic farm, we can produce the produce we need and the products we need in this country farming organically.
Okay. Thank you, Suchit, for that question. Let me go to Lou in San Francisco. Good evening, Lou. Thank you for calling in.
Hi. First, what is a policy template that cities could use to generate and produce greater support and boosterism for local farmers? And the way that there's always a tacit kind of chamber of commerce, bring your business here, for other businesses, what could cities do that would really show and reach out to local farmers to become part of their scene, specific policies? And The other question is, what is a form of cooperation and a kind of cooperative approach that local farms could do to join together to get some economies and maybe distribution or other forms of association that would increase their strength and their capacity to bargain and push for policies that would support themselves?
That's great. Lou, are you a farmer or are you just interested?
I want to see local farms embedded in cities and to see policies in the city level that would be like the planning policies that do development for farms within cities, or reach out into the kind of development shed of the city area to link specific farms to that city and to a set of stores that would distribute their vegetables and produce and meat on a regular basis.
Jason, you're in San Francisco. Thank you, Lou. You're in San Francisco, and you've been dealing with some policy issues in San Francisco. Maybe you could talk to that.
Yeah,
and
so it sounds like there's a couple of questions there. One is, you know, what can we do to maybe grow some more of our food in urban centers? And I think it's important to know that, you know, a city like San Francisco is never going to be food self-sufficient, nor should it be. That's not the ideas of cities, right? We're not going to grow wheat on the panhandle. We're not going to grow rice down on Moffett Field. But there's, you know, a lot of, sorry for the pun, low-hanging fruit that cities and municipalities can do to increase some of our own fruit and vegetable production or some of our own small-scale animal husbandry in the cities. I think one of the easiest things cities can do is to make sure, and this is actually an issue for the Public Utilities Commission, is to make sure that there's dual metering for homes.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and...
Well, hopefully Lou is still listening. is to have dual metering. So if you're trying to grow a significant amount of fruits and vegetables and you're paying a residential water rate, it's going to become uneconomical real fast. And one thing that the PUC could do is to make it easier to get a second meter installed so you can get some sort of ag rate for your water if you're actually growing a fair amount of fruits and vegetables. And also, I think, make the rules around small-scale animal husbandry a little more lenient. But I guess the second question, though, is, you know, what can cities do to encourage those truck farms, let's say like freewheeling farms? And I think, you know, that's more of a question less for like the city and county of San Francisco than it is maybe for like San Mateo County or Sonoma County. But I think one thing they can do is to make it easier and to help grease the way for people to put their land holdings in agricultural land trusts and help protect our agricultural land. Because especially in places like Northern California, where you've got such high real estate costs, we're losing farmland. You can see it down south of where Daryl is, where you literally see the sprawl in Monterey starting to chew up prime agricultural land. And so there's any number of things. There's a great group called American Farmland Trust, but there's any number of things that counties can do to make it easier to protect our ag lands so we don't lose them to sprawl and development.
You know, this, can I?
Maureen, Wilmot, yes, please.
This is not so much what a city can do, but they can look at it from the national level, and all farmers are facing the two biggest hurdles are access to capital and access to land. And for organic farmers, it's even more problematic, because if you go in to try to get a loan as an organic farmer to buy the farm, the loan officer doesn't have the information out there to put that loan together, because all the information that's collected on market data for farming is based on conventional farming. Mm. So they can't say, how much are you going to make? What's going to be your rate of return on that land? So we need to make sure on the national level that we have policies in place. Again, this is about building that infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So someone who wants to buy farm and farm it organically has the structure there so that loan officer can give them the information.
Maureen, how far off do you think we are before we would have something like that?
Well, as the other folks have talked about, we have the 2012 Farm Bill, and this is one of the things that we're working on, is that there's money kept in the Farm Bill, so USDA can keep collecting that information in the marketing service for organic farming.
Okay. Let me go to an we have another person on the line. We have Sharon from San Rafael. Good evening, Sharon.
Hello?
Hi, is this Sharon?
Yes, it is.
Hi, thank you for calling City Visions.
Okay. Yeah, I love this. I mean, I've been listening to it the whole time. The only contention that I have here is this. It is, you can't, it's so difficult to buy organic today if you don't have the income for it. We live, you know, here we are. We live near a place called Good Earth. We've got Whole Foods near us in San Rafael. Who can buy an organic avocado for $3? Who can buy, who can go to the farmer's market and buy the meat? I mean, I would love to give my family organic food. But my husband was in between jobs for 2 years. I was laid off to part-time. It's impossible to buy organic.
Well, you know, let me, you know, Sharon, let me actually give a twist to your question and ask our panel. You know, if for people that can't, they can't afford to buy right now the groceries at the prices, you know, what are some of the other options? I mean, like, obviously growing in their backyard might be. What are some of the other options for people that go to the Whole Foods or go to the Good Earth or whatnot and see these exorbitant prices? I mean, are CSAs really the way to go? You know, are there kind of bargain CSAs that they can choose from?
Marin Farmers Market is so expensive. I feel like they're almost sneering at you, like when they see the prices. You know what? I went there. It was $3.95 for strawberries. Organic, which tasted fabulous.
Yes.
I went to United Market. They were $1.95. They tasted terrible, but they're organic.
Right. I think this is kind of what these guys are talking about, too, just in terms of, you know, how long stores have to keep them. I don't know. But anyway, Daryl, why don't we start with you? Do you have any suggestions for people like Sharon?
Well, I think that... you know, I always get wrapped up on the price of organic food because I feel like when you really pit, you know, those who can't afford food against organic farmers who aren't making enough money already, you're really pitting kind of two losers in the whole economic system against each other. And really, the debate should really be, you know, why aren't some of these companies that are making record profits right now actually paying their workers what they should be paid so that they can actually spend a percentage of their annual income on food that's comparable with the rest of the world so that farmers can actually make enough? Because when I hear you say that, you know, I can't spend $3 on an organic avocado, maybe you shouldn't buy, you know, that avocado, you know, it had to fly from somewhere, you know, or maybe it just came up from Southern California. Maybe that's a choice that you decide not to make in a tight economy. But, you know, when you say that non-organic head of lettuce is maybe 50 cents or a dollar, and an organic head of lettuce is maybe $1.50 or $2, I think that might be, you know, 50 cents or a dollar.
Hey, Daryl, I hate to cut you off, but we are, like, at the top of the hour. So is there, like, one sentence that you're one teeny tip that that we could end the show with for people, like, that you could just give to people, just one little sentence before I actually have to give the credits?
Spend your money wisely and put your money where your mouth is. You know, buy stuff that tastes good that you know is good for you.
Okay. I wish we could talk more about it. Maybe we have to have another show. Anyway, this is City Visions. That's City Visions for the evening. Our guests tonight were Jason Mark, co-manager of San Francisco's Alamany Farm and editor of Earth Island Journal, Maureen Wilmot, executive director of the Organic Farming Research Foundation, and Daryl Wong, farmer and co-owner of Free Will and Farm. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Thank you, Eric. Our live phones were managed by our senior producer, City Visions, Judith Sanson. Thank you so much, Judith. City Visions founder is Rose Levinson, and our other contributing producers are Susie Britton, Lisa Denmark, and Yumi Wilson. Neil Fries manages our website. Join us. Join City Visions next week when we explore San Francisco's Care Not Cash program. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.